Okay, I hereby call to order the Fall 2007 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. All right. You all having fun out there? Good. You ready to learn a few things? Maybe get some door prizes as well? All right. I'm catering to the crowd as usual. Okay. We're going to start with our invocation first. We'll do the flag salute afterward. We'll reverse our order. Today we're lucky to have one of us, a blind guy among us, this time to give our invocation. They're very cool. I didn't even know. He was looking for me. I was looking for him, you know. But we managed it. We did it. Reverend Jeffrey Sims, Associate Minister, New Congregational Missionary Baptist Church, Los Angeles, California. I present Mr. Sims for our invocation.
There you go. Pass you the wireless mic. Most holy and wise, eternal God, our Father, we are assembly here today, first of all, just to say thank you. We thank you for last night when we lied down and we slept and slumbered and not even knowing what state we was in, you found favor with us. And early this morning, you touched us with your finger of love, allowing our eyes to come open, allowing us to have the operations of our limb. You clothed us in our right minds, and we want to say thank you. We thank you for each and every one that is present today. We thank you for the families from which they came. We thank you for the president that you placed up over this great organization. We pray that thou will continue to strengthen him, guide him, and lead him in the way that you would have him to go. We pray for those that are under him. Oh, we just saying thank you, my Heavenly Father. We pray, my Heavenly Father, that thou would just bless each one that's going to present something, each exhibit. Give us wisdom, knowledge, and understanding to receive that which you would have us to receive. And we thank you. And then, my Heavenly Father, when we get ready to depart from this place, we pray that thou will give us traveling grace to our various destinations. Allow us to find everything as it was when we left. Now these and all blessings we ask. In thy precious name we pray. Amen. Thank God.
Thank you very much, Reverend. We're glad Mr. Sims is going to be able to stick around with us for a little while and listen to some of the proceedings. And it's great to see that. I hope you enjoy your stay with us. Thank you. John Ross, are you in the room? Okay, well, sometimes, are you nominating, the nominations are now open for the flag salute. Are you nominating Miss Cardis to do the flag salute? Okay, do you want, Jane, would you like to come forward and do the pledge today? Since Ron has so graciously put your name up.
Okay, I hope I don't blow this.
Just tell us to stand.
Would you like to stand, please? And if you wish, you can put your hand over your heart, your choice. Okay, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
She wasn't John Ross. Maybe she was Betsy Ross. On this organization, we use them no matter how old or young they may be. Okay. Announcements. I'm going to recognize that has been of CCB lore, Mitch Pomerantz, in a minute. But before I do that, I want to update you all on Ed Branch. You haven't seen much of him this weekend. He is here. He's spending most of his he went to emergency yesterday, got some tests run. He's had a very severe virus and just a lot of tiredness, and he's got some, you know, a lot of bed rest, some good drugs, And he's just staying knocked out most of the time, laying low. He is doing okay, but you know, he's hoping to, you know, be down here tomorrow amongst us and you know, get to the banquet and do as much as he can. But right now we're just trying to, you know, protect his health and get him better. And so if there's a little bit of if there's a snafu here and there, you'll just have to go with the flow a little bit. You know, we certainly miss his presence, but you know, I want to hear it for the great volunteers, Mary Lou, Pinky, and that whole staff. Yeah. And the outstanding work that Diana Sandel, our new employee, is doing. Let's hear it for her. Yes, yes. So, you know, we're moving right along. And hopefully Ed will be back here tomorrow with us. But right now he's just sort of laying low and taking it easy. Mitch, do you want to get to a mic?
Thank you, Jeff. Obviously, there are an awful lot of people who think the time changed or something because they're not here. I asked Jeff to give me a couple of minutes on the program, and I'll be talking about it tonight a little bit. But those of you who were at the board meeting last night know that one of the critical issues for the California Council of the Blind, and it's always a critical issue for ACB, is money, is funding. And we have an opportunity to, you know, folks are talking about twofers. We have an opportunity for the members of CCB to get a twofer. We have forms here for our monthly monetary support program, which allows you to have regular contributions made from either your checking account or a credit card. And the board of directors of ACB, I think it was last year, decided that in order to assist state affiliates and special interest affiliates, we would open up the program such that a member who wishes to may designate up to 50% of his or her contribution to the state or special interest affiliate of his or her choice. So your twofer is the opportunity to make a regular monthly contribution to the American Council of the Blind, as well as a regular monthly contribution to the California Council of the Blind. And so we brought forms. They are at the registration table. They are the newest forms because they have changed a bit. And I don't expect necessarily that everybody here who wanted to sign up has brought the necessary information, but I would strongly encourage you, if you've been thinking about it at all, to stop by registration today or tomorrow until they run out. Hopefully they'll run out of them. And pick up an MMS form. It takes all of about 5 minutes to fill it out with your bank or credit card information. It's perfectly safe. I'll also tell you, no one from myself to any of our board knows who is contributing. It is secret. It is safe, and it's a wonderful way to show your commitment to ACB as well as to CCB. So with that, I've made my pitch, and hopefully some folks will be willing to take advantage of the opportunity. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Okay. What I'm going to do before we go to our first speaker is one of the things I want to do during the course of the weekend is recognize for a few minutes, and we're going to do one state this afternoon, and we'll catch some other unwary guests as the time goes along. First, we want to recognize our state visitors from out of state to tell us a little bit about what's going on for a few moments in their affiliate. And the first one is one of the great ladies of this organization and one of the finest, finest people that I have come to know in the last however long we've known each other. I mean, I drive her crazy when my braille note breaks, but other than that, she likes me. The Secretary of the Washington Council of the Blind, the Secretary of the American Council of the Blind, and various other hats, Marlena Lieberg, to tell us a little bit about Washington Council of the Blind. And right now, due to her outstanding skill, we are streaming around the country and around the world on ACB Radio. So, Marlena.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I think I'm in the back of the room and you're in the front of the room. And if your braille note's broken, stay there. I bring you all greetings from Washington State. We love you guys. We're looking forward to our convention next weekend, which will be streamed on ACB Radio. So make sure you give us a listen and give us a hard time. You know, we like that in Washington. You know, we're the rowdy people. Oh, you guys are catching up to us now. Hang on a minute here. Can you catch up to Washington State?
Yeah!
Are you going to have a great convention?
Yeah!
We'd be louder than that. Are you going to have a great convention?
Yeah!
Well, you're almost there. Good job. Just to kind of give you an idea about what's going on in Washington State, we are a state that is dealing with issues with our library system. So the Washington Council of the Blind is very much involved with that. We have one of our members is on the Patron Advisory Council, and she's also working on the transition team. Our library is moving to be run by the state, which we think is a good thing. And so we have actually two members on that transition team. Our president, Cindy Van Winkle, is the new chair of the State Rehab Council. And so we are continuing to work very hard in Washington to be the organization that makes a difference in the lives of the blind. And thank you. And thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back in California.
Thank you, Marlena. It's great when she is able to come here. I want to introduce to you, and he'll introduce his staff that's with him, although she needs no introduction.
Well, no, I know who it was, but I wasn't going to give it away.
Oh!
I want to introduce to you a gentleman who had a long and incredibly wonderful discussion with at lunch, met him and was able to have a great dialogue with this gentleman. He's following in the footsteps of an outstanding director of rehabilitation, and he's really looking like he's going to be every bit as effective when it comes to the issues that we hold so dear of employment and other skills important to blind and visually impaired persons as was his predecessor, Dr. Catherine Campisi. The new director, Anthony Sauer, has a long tradition of work in the disability movement, most recently with respect to working for a public authority in the in-home supportive services field. I want to introduce to you to talk about his plans for the future and his beliefs, Anthony Sauer, Director, Department of Rehabilitation. Anthony?
Thank you, Jeff. And thanks for that nice introduction. I do go by Tony, so those of you who know me, you'll know it's not a different person. Somebody calls me Anthony. Also, to my right, to your left, is Catherine Bales, who is our district administrator for the Blind Field Services. And I've really enjoyed the 2.5 months since I've been back to the department working with Catherine. Following in Catherine Campisi's footsteps is a difficult job, particularly when it comes to issues around people with blindness and visual impairments. Catherine had Ralph, for those of you who know, and as much as I like Ralph, I'm not going to be sleeping with him. So I look to you all, and I still look to Ralph. We, Catherine and Ralph and I, get together regularly and talk. So I don't have that firsthand experience that Catherine did. So I appreciate the conversations, and I will be asking a lot of questions. And having lunch today with Jeff and Mitch and Donna was very helpful, and many of the groups that have come to me. And I do ask a lot of questions, and people may want to hear more of my vision and what I believe the department, where we can be. But at this point, mostly I want to hear what you think needs to be done. And one of the things I've talked to Tony Candela, and I believe I've talked to Catherine Bales about it, and I talked to the folks at lunch, was about getting a group together, actually a couple of small groups, another one came up today, to look at programs like our Business Enterprise Program and what we can do to improve the program, and also what can the vendors do to improve the program. It doesn't need to all be on the department's shoulders. I think there's some room for improvement. And what can we do? I don't have any solid ideas of what I think has to be done. I think I have some thoughts of maybe some better marketing and some better branding. But what can we do? And so I want to get one or two folks from each of the constituent groups and come together, and some of our department, and sit down and do some brainstorming, and then see what's real, what we can do with the limited funds we're going to have available. But I think much of it is just some visioning. We have a vacancy as the director of that department, and as we hire the new person there, I hope we can get a fresh start and really look at some new ideas. And there are other groups. The Orientation Center for the Blind came up at lunch today, and maybe there's some we need to look at what can be improved there. Our enrollment is down. How can we increase that? How can we make changes to make it a better program? Or change it in many, many ways. I really don't have any ownership about what needs to be done, but I do think that as the enrollment has decreased, there's obviously something amiss, and we need to figure out what that is. So those are the kind of two primary issues that I really want, that I see that we could work on together. And it would be wonderful if we could have everybody in this room work on a committee, but that's not realistic. So, and I haven't decided whether I'll take one or two from each group, but I think no more than two, so that we can have a group that's reasonable. And I would hope to do this over a couple of sessions, not drag it out over years and years, and really lay out a plan of what needs to be done and improved. I know with Tony Candela's leadership, he really wants to see things change. And, I'm hoping I'll be here longer than this governor. As Catherine was able to go through two governors. But even so, I really think I am in a race with the clock. I have about 3.5 years of time to get some things accomplished. And, that sounds like a long time, but that'll come and go in a hurry, as we all know. So that being said, I definitely want to hear from you all what your issues are. But I'm going to see if Catherine, do you have anything you want to add, Catherine? Any
sure.
Thoughts? Okay, let Catherine say a few things.
They told me how to do this.
Here, let's use this one.
Hello?
There we go.
I got it. I'm not as bad with AT as I thought. Okay. Well, first of all, it is a pleasure to be here, as always. This is only my second time to be here at, the other one was at the Spring Convention up in Sacramento as the new DA, the new program manager for Blind Field Services. And I'm really excited about what we're doing and some of the changes that we want to make with Tony Sauer's direction. I think we're very, very fortunate to have Tony as our new director. I'm looking forward to some great things happening. I was able to meet with the Rehab Services Committee yesterday. We talked about different AT issues and what have you. Those are always going to be issues with us. But I want to emphasize again that we believe that AT is the tools that can help us to do our job, that can help us compete in school. And we need to use the best ones for the individual person and that takes a lot of work just determining what that is. So we're going to work with you on that. The other thing is that I want to really encourage you. Our applications in some areas have been down. We need applications. We want to provide services to individuals with vision loss from the ages of, 16 to what, 95? So let us know. Get the word out that we are here. I'm always amazed at how many areas, how many people never heard of Department of Rehabilitation, never knew that we had services that we could provide them. So let's get the word out. I'm going to count on all of you to help me do that. And especially with our transition age youth, 16 to 22, please, let's get the word out that we want to be partners with our schools. We want to help our young people to develop the skills, the knowledge that they need so that they can really compete for employment in the areas that are best for them. I said one time that I think people with vision loss can do almost any job out there, all right, except for being a pilot and a driver and a couple of those little basic things. But otherwise, you know, AT is allowing us to do almost anything. And if you've got the skills, the knowledge, the desire, we want to be there to help you through those different goals. Okay, I want to field some of the questions, too, that you might have. I was going to make the announcement, and I'm going to go ahead and make it. Casey Cook. I don't know how many of you know Casey Cook. Yeah? Well, I just promoted Casey Cook to be the rehab supervisor for the Westchester branch area. So you can look forward to having his direction down here in L.A. And I think that's going to be a wonderful, wonderful asset for Blind Field Services. I'm really looking forward to getting to know Casey better. And we are going to be hiring new counselors down in the San Diego area and up north as well. So stay tuned. And if you know people that are qualified, that have their master's in rehab counseling, make sure they take the exam, the online exam. That's just come out about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago. So if people are in the master's program for rehab counseling, if they're going to be graduating soon, we want them to take the exam. Get online, take that exam. If you know people who are interested in becoming a rehab counselor for the blind or just a rehab counselor, a senior vocational rehabilitation counselor, qualified rehabilitation professional, that means they have their master's in rehab counseling or something related, please encourage them to get their education and then take the exam, and hopefully they can come on board and work with us. We'd love to work with them. Okay, I'm going to turn it back out to all of you for any questions that you might have.
This is Rhonda King. This question is for Tony Sauer. And I'm a member of the Blind Advisory Committee for the Department of Rehab. And we have recently come down with a recommendation that rehab counselors try to differentiate between centers that target specialized services rather than independent living centers, even though they may be in the same area. And our spring resolution 2007A5 called for DOR to implement the Blind Advisory Committee's recommendation as policy and try their, you know, perhaps counselors do their best to refer blind and visually impaired people to centers who have the specialized services rather than the independent living centers. And I'd like to know if you've read the resolution, and if so, what are your thoughts on it, and how do you believe that this can actually be implemented as policy?
I guess I have not seen that resolution. I thought I read your minutes from that meeting. So, Kathy, do you want to?
Yeah. Hi. Could you kind of give us a little bit briefer, some more information, and I will try my best, and Tony will too, to address it. But maybe help us, don't just refer to the resolution, give us a little bit more meat, and we'll do our best.
Okay,
do
we have any other questions?
No.
Well,
do you want her to expand on the resolution?
Does anybody have the resolution? Or,
I mean, we don't need it all read to us. I just want to know.
It's just that, you know, you're given options. And there's many times that you have centers in the same locations.
Okay.
Where there's a center that has specialized services.
Right.
Specifically for blind and visually impaired.
Right.
And other centers that are just independent living centers that cater to all disabilities.
Right.
And we are, Blind Advisory Committee is actually wanting door counselors to refer clients, blind and visually impaired clients, to the centers who have the specialized services over the other independent living centers who, you know, have other services.
Okay, I'll go from there. You know, our counselors work on the premise of our regulation for informed choice. We provide our consumers, whatever their disability is, with information about the services, the centers that are available. And hopefully we would describe to them, or they can have tours of those facilities. So then we do leave it up, not consumer choice, but informed choice as to which center they want to go to for the services that they need. For people that are blind or visually impaired, if there is a center that's available, close, that provides the services that are necessary for the individual, the consumer who is blind or visually impaired, I would probably think that would be the better place to go, but you know what? You don't always know. There could be another place. I would prefer that they go to the center that really does specializes with the skills for somebody who's blind or visually impaired. But you know, an independent living center just might have those kind of services at that location. I don't know. Well, I know you. I heard you say they don't. You're probably right, but I would like to find out for sure, okay? And we do have informed choice, and I hope that our counselors aren't just dictating to any consumer where they need to go without their input.
Dan Kaiser.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, Tony. Director Sauer, it's a pleasure seeing you in the governor's office the other day.
Yes, same here.
And a big congratulations to you. My question is, this year and it may be next year, we'll see we saw a rather large, lengthy budget stalemate. What can you do to ensure a smooth reimbursement for students, that the operations of the department aren't interrupted, that the orientation center would continue? I know that there was an alert that the OCB was going to close in September if the funding didn't kick in. So what can you do to ensure federal funds to offset any deficits related to a budget freeze?
Man, you guys aren't tossing me softballs here, are you? You know, the budget stalemate was difficult for everybody, as we all know. The big problem is that we can't pay bills, period. And even though we're getting federal pass-through monies coming through, my understanding is the state process won't let us pay that. I don't know what I can do, Dan. All I can try to assure you is that we somehow figure a way to keep programs open as best we can. I'm hoping that we don't have a stalemate like that again. My worry, though, frankly, is we're looking at a $10 billion plus deficit going into next year, and I think it is going to be a problem. I'll just tell you, you know, you have my word that I'll do whatever I can behind the scenes, and I don't want to see OCB or any program. We had college students that couldn't go to school. For the most part, counselors were being very creative and brokering deals with the college bookstores and staff at the universities. And I think we had almost everybody get into school when they were supposed to. But it was a lot of extra work on our staff and a lot of stress on the consumers, and I don't want to see that again. Yeah. So I can tell you I'll do whatever I can. But Dan, also, you guys have to do your part. And as you know that, the folks in this room, the citizens, are the ones who can put the pressure on the legislature to pass a budget more than I can. And Catherine before me and Brenda before Catherine do whatever we can behind the scenes. And you probably won't see that or even know that that's going on, but we will do our part, and I'm committed to that because I surely don't want to see anybody get delayed even a week for a program. So thank you.
Yeah, if I could follow up on that, Dan. There are certain areas pursuant to state legislation that the state has the ability to draw down federal funding in the event of a budget crisis, and then essentially the state pays the federal government back out of the budget appropriation once the budget is passed. And it's our hope that some thought is given to assuming that this is permissible with federal rehab funds, and it's our understanding that it may well be, that some hope is given to similar state legislation for the Department of Rehabilitation to protect consumers and providers in areas in the event of a similar crisis to what occurred this year. Okay. Any other questions?
Looks like there's somebody in the back with a microphone.
Go ahead. Hi, this is Jessie from the Lighthouse in San Francisco. Yesterday we spoke about impediments to employment related to technology. One of the common problems for folks who are blind, once they actually get a job and start working, there's often a long lull or waiting period for them to get technology. Sometimes it's because of the department's bureaucracy. Sometimes it's because of an employer's kind of being slow on the ball to purchase technology. Can you talk a little bit about that and how we as kind of outside advocates might work to make that better?
Let me start the answer and then I'll give it to Catherine. I think when somebody shows up for work, they ought to be able to go to work. And we are looking at ways to streamline our process, and unfortunately, many times an argument ensues about who's to pay for it. And Catherine has some great ideas about, that we, particularly the private employer, we could help with the equipment, and then as they get it, they get the equipment that they need, then ours would be given back, and we can use it for the next person. That may be one answer. With the state agencies, it's another problem. Because they can't claim that they can't afford it, essentially. But at the same time, we don't want to discourage folks with disabilities or from them from hiring folks with disabilities. So I think our department needs to be more creative and work closer with other state departments when they want to hire somebody with a disability. And the answer to that might be to have a general buying pool so that a department can just call whoever, it could be us, to say, I have a blind person, they need this software, they need that system, and it's delivered in a few days. Because as you know, much of the equipment is similar. There's some refinements that need to be made individually, but a lot of it is very similar. So if we have that system so a department can't say, listen, I'm afraid to hire this blind person because it's going to cost $8,000 out of my line item, I think it'll help to get folks hired with disabilities. And at the same time, the equipment should be ready for them when they start. And then Catherine wants to add.
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit. It's very true. I think we can be creative. We've worked with the federal government. We've worked with private employers. We are trying to find creative ways to be able to make sure that equipment is on the job when the person shows up. We have to do that. We know that employers may have a bad image of people who are blind or visually impaired, you know, that they can't do the job. And we don't want them seeing us sitting around not doing the job. we want to be working. So I want all of our consumers to be able to do that. There's ways, I know there's ways that we can do it. It begins with dialogue. Our counselors need to be having a dialogue with employers. We have job developers who are working with our different agencies. They need to be having a dialogue. We need to start working with what's needed for that consumer, for that individual. We need to talk about that right away. We need to start the ball rolling right away. And whether it be, I don't want to hear, well, it's their responsibility, I'm not going to do it. I want to say, okay, let's, what can we do together? Let's get this done. With some employers, we have even been able to do, okay, they will purchase this or that, and we'll purchase something else. You know, we do it as a shared process. So we're not being one person stuck with all the bill. With the state agencies, it's my understanding that it doesn't come out of the employer's line item for that particular department, that if there really is a special area where it comes out, that is for reasonable accommodation, and that money is there. So we need to work with our state agencies. We need to work with employers in general. We need to give them information. We need to keep the dialogue moving.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Now is the time.
Yes.
You have. Great. Let's get...
Okay. I'm with Richard. And this is Tricia Fleets and Chidruetta. Hello.
Hello.
Okay. The one thing that's been going on for about 1 year at the department is our computers have been working excessively slow, crashing probably several times a day, and it's really hard for us to get our work done. If we open an attachment, sometimes it can take up to 10 minutes. So I tried to get rid of the attachment so I can keep working in another program like Sidor to keep going. So anyway, if there's anything we can do to bring more attention to the issue to resolve it, I'd be grateful. And I'm just saying it because I really want to help people, help the consumers. And
I'll just echo what Tricia said, that even in our state building in Oakland, we have computers that crash, our Outlook crashes, and we open up attachments with JAWS, with Zoom Text, with everything we're working with. And it's painful because we're taking a lot more time to get our work done than we need to. And I just wanted to see if time can be spent into looking into investigating into why this has been going on for a year. And I know Kathy's been working with us, but I'm wondering if maybe at your level something can be done as well.
Do you want me to answer now, Trish or Jeff?
Sure.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Actually, I was just talking to Catherine before we came in here about this, and she mentioned that the system in Los Angeles was actually completely down this morning, although she was online, but other people weren't. So I called our new IT person, Pat Santelinas, and asked her about it. She said, yes, in fact, Department of General Services server in Southern California, actually the router went down, so that's why there was a problem today. But then I asked a question about the other offices, particularly in the Bay Area, that people are getting logged off. And she said that, one, when that happens, you need to call the help desk so they can report it, because then they know they have immediately, so they can track this, that there's a problem. Don't call. I mean, you can call somebody else and say, hey, is yours up, and work on, you know, the behind-the-scenes things. But we need to know in central office that there's a problem. And then, thirdly, she said that she's new to the department. I believe she's been there about 5 or 6 months. And now that we're into our new building, she's committed to improving the technology, particularly for folks with assistive technology in the department. So Pat wants to hear and wants to work and make it better. So that was her commitment just a few minutes ago.
Okay. Thanks. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Hi, this is Jerry Arakawa. With the Department of Rehabilitation, and glad to see both of you. Strictly an inside issue that affects all consumers, I think. I think I would echo just about every rehab counselor. I'm a supervisor, so I see a lot of cases like this come across my desk. One of the worst dynamics that have occurred recently to slow the whole process of purchase of equipment and services is the dreadful bidding process that's happened. With this, now I understand that this is an attempt to make sure that all contractors, all vendors have an equal playing field, and that nobody gets sole source an extra advantage over another vendor. However, what this has done is to slow services at a very basic level. When counselors have to go out in the field, they have to do competitive bidding for something that they know is a sole source, that they have a pretty good idea which vendor has the best services or the best product given that particular circumstance. And I think counselors know better than the supervisor, certainly know better than the administrator, what's out in the field and what's most efficient as far as what might best serve the consumer. The problem is we're about the only department I know in the state that purchases goods and services on a very individual basis. You know, when Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation goes out and buys mattresses, they may buy them by the 10,000 lot or the 1,000 lot of this merchandise. Well, we buy computers one at a time for blind or visually impaired people. We provide independent living aids, one consumer at a time. And for us to have to go through a bidding process, for the counselors to have to do this, is a real drag on the services and the provision of those services. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I'll take a crack at it, and I'm sure Kathy has something to say. We're looking at two pilots right now. Actually, we're starting two pilots in the state that aren't specifically for the blind counselors, but they're to get procurement specialists within the districts. So it would be a counselor. It's a voluntary position. A counselor would be a specialist in doing the purchasing within the district so that the 20 or 30 counselors in a particular area don't all have to call Big O Tires when somebody needs tires for a vehicle, or don't all have to call Gateway to find a computer and assistive technology. The one person would have it, and it would be doing bids, and would be able to use those bids for several weeks, if not a few months, so they wouldn't have to keep going out and doing the same thing over and over. So we're hoping that speeds up the process. We are different than most California departments. We do a lot of purchasing. The counselors have a lot of authority to buy things, which is very unusual within the state structure. But I think there is room for improvement. And one of the goals that I didn't talk about for me is to have more face time for the counselors with the consumers. And one of those things that they can do is to get off the telephone with the vendors getting bids for all kinds of miscellaneous things, including books and supplies and computers, and get in front of the consumers. So that is something we're working on, and I wish I could take all the credit, but of course the ball was rolling before I got here. But maybe I can have a little bit of credit at the end. But it really was rolling, and I think that Catherine Campisi and the staff really have heard that concern, Jerry, and it is moving. Do you want to add to that?
I really don't have too much to add to it. I'm aware of the pilot programs. I'm looking forward to seeing that this is going to make a difference. I agree with Tony. We need to have our counselors working directly with our consumers and not having to do all the bidding of getting the quotes. So let's see what's going to happen. We hope that the pilot programs are going to prove to be successful. At least we'll find out what's working and what isn't, and we'll make it work better. It's not easy. I know it's not easy. I spent a lot of my time today reviewing all these authorizations and approving and from the DA level, because, of course, with our consumers in Blind Field Services, most of the equipment requires a DA approval, so I'm busy doing those kind of approvals all day. I read through the case notes, and I know what's been going on as far as getting those. Don't forget to use the fair and reasonable. That is an option, and that can save a lot of time. So I hear you, and we all want to help with this.
Hi, my name is Loretta Batron, and I wanted to state a few couple of things in the best way that I can. I hope that divine intervention will help me with this, to say the right things at the right time. I came here to learn, and I came here for a feeling that I want to leave with a feeling of empowerment. I don't know whether everybody else wants empowerment, that's what I came here for. I feel that employment for the blind is at a real standstill, and a lot of people do not feel that way, and I'm sorry that a lot of people don't see. As a young girl, as a teenager, as a young college student, as a 30-year-old, as a 40-year-old, and now I don't want to say my age, but something has occurred in my beingness that's not the same as it was. And I grew up as a very proactive, very strong, very powerful, very empowered individual. And something has just choked that deeply. And I feel sorry for that, not for me, but for the integrity of the blind in and of itself. We are a powerful, powerful individualization of ourselves. And something happens when I feel that, and I'm not putting down, but I feel that retarded people get more vocation than we do. I wanted to be a recording engineer for many, many years, and I wanted to get into record producing and producing of talent. And they told me that it wasn't possible for a blind person to do that. And I still believe that it is. I want to know if there's anything I can do. I call my rehab counselors over and over and over, and I don't get response. And then I call them again, and I don't get response. And I call their supervisors, and they keep calling me and asking me if I want a job, and I say, I do. And I'm 54 years old, and I still don't have a job. Something is wrong with that. And if anybody would like to say that we are wonderful blind people that can do anything we choose to do, who will clap for that? I want people to believe in us, and I want sighted people that work for the blind to believe in us. And I believe in us, and I believe in everybody in this room that's here for a reason. I want to state that there really needs to be more work, and I really believe that rehab and jobs for the blind need more work. Please, amen to that. Can anyone agree and say amen to that?
Okay, I'm going to take it for just a second. Number one, if I really don't want to hear anything about rehab counselors not returning phone calls, so I'm hoping you didn't say that. I would really like to hear that our rehab counselors are returning phone calls within 24 hours. And if they can't, they're going to get back to you as soon as possible. And let me give you my phone number, okay? It's 916. I got a new number, so you better write it down. 916-558-5483. Okay? I'm here to try to help. That is the policy I have. I want phone calls returned. The other is, you want it again? Okay. Okay. 916. That's the area code, 558-5483. That's my direct line. Nobody else picks it up. Okay? So if there's a reason that you haven't been able to get a hold of somebody, I want you to call me. I invite you to call me. I want people who are blind or visually impaired to go to work. We have to have you going to work. You know, it's a big job. Looking for a job is a full-time job. I used to be a job developer way back when. I had to work at getting a job too before I became employed. So I know it's a big job. I want to help you do that. We've got to get more qualified people in the field who are job developers, job placement specialists, people who really know how to help people who are blind or visually impaired go to work. But the people, our consumers, all of you who are looking for work, you really have to consider it a full-time job.
We don't give you a job. I kind of heard you say, and I don't think you meant to say, jobs for the blind. Let's not think about jobs for the blind. We look for employment. And a person who is blind or visually impaired just happens to be doing that job. It's not jobs for the blind. So let's work together as partners in helping people with vision loss go to work. That's my goal. I know that's Tony's goal. That's our goal for all of our consumers. But it's a partnership with you. And we have to have, I'm pretty sure I know what your vocational goal, what you want to do. You know, there's probably a way. But we have to have people who are really good, skilled counselors working with our consumers. And they have to think outside the box. We all have to think outside the box these days. We have to help people go to work in the careers that they think are appropriate. And maybe they're not appropriate, but, you know, let's give you a try. Okay? Here's Tony.
I want to add to that just a little bit. Some of you know where I came from and how I came to the department, but I'll brief the rest of you, and I'll make this quick. In 1978, right after my 18th birthday, I was paralyzed in a motocross racing accident at the L.A. Coliseum. And my life changed instantly. I came to the Department of Rehabilitation not sure what I wanted to do, knew I couldn't race motorcycles anywhere. And my rehab counselor and I sat down, and we talked, and about the only thing that we could come up with was that I liked woodworking and I would be a cabinet maker. And he supported that goal, to be a cabinet maker. Well, I soon found out that there weren't many cabinet shops in my community that were going to hire a paraplegic cabinet maker. So he helped me with a self-employment plan. I went to Sierra College, learned the trade, and I became self-employed. And with a lot of guidance and support from the counselor, but it was my way of doing what I wanted to do, be a cabinet maker, and finding work and making a living. I still don't know many cabinet makers that would hire a paraplegic, no matter how good the rehab counselor was or how good I would have been. So a lot of it is based upon what you're willing to do, and the counselor can do whatever they can do to help. And again, my counselor thought outside the box. He helped me with a vocational goal that was really not a normal goal for a paraplegic, particularly in 1978. And I know the counselors, there are some wonderful ones, and there are some that maybe need a little bit of guidance. But I'm sure if you work together, you can make it work. But it is a team effort. Please don't look the department to do it for you. It's to do it as a partner with you. Okay, that looks like another question.
Okay, yes, we have time for one more question, and we've had Ed Crespin, another department employee, has been standing out there for a long time. And so we're going to have him be our last questioner.
My question is, Tony, you had mentioned that we're going to have a rehab counselor do the possible purchasing of the equipment. Is that the goal? Maybe you have a pilot program to do that?
Yeah, right now there's a pilot that's starting up in the Sacramento Chico District, and I believe Van Nuys, one of the ones in Southern California, to see if this is possible.
Okay, I'm kind of wondering about that because it seems like rehab counselors, voc rehab counselors, have many hats, and we've done a lot of different jobs. We do the intake all the way to the placement and doing OJTs and even doing job development. And the big problem we've had in the past is that we had had, in our area, we've had counselors do the intakes only because it was really overwhelming. Then for a while there, we wanted to get rid of the MCs, so we all were calling each other doctors because we were supposed to review all the medicals and make our decisions, which, you know, I mean, we're pretty good at that, but the MC really helped. Now it looks like you're wanting us to be purchasing agents, so we're taking a counselor away to just do the purchasing. I think that should be a job classification, not a counselor's job, if you're going to do that. The second thing is that some of these counselors that we have are leaving the department because they're overwhelmed and overworked.
Yeah, this would be my understanding, Ed, and I'm not clear on this. Maybe Catherine could find out and get back to you, or maybe she knows, is that it would be a specialist, somebody whose job it is to do the purchasing. And do you want to?
Well, that would have to be a specialist, you know, with a pay to go with it.
Right. Okay. Now, we really have to get our facts straight on this, because I was under the impression from attending a DA meeting, a district administrator meeting, that it was going to be a support staff person was going to do the purchasing. I didn't think it was going to be a rehab counselor. So I want to make sure that we're all on this, you know, that that's accurate too for myself. They're doing a pilot so that they can try to see what's going to work, what isn't going to work. I understand what you're saying. We'll get all the facts and we'll get them out there. I think it's going to be, we'll have a message that will be going out before long about that.
Okay, now you, right.
Ed, I'm going to cut you off because Doug Martin has also been standing. We got 30 seconds left. And I'm going to, Doug, you're going to have to ask a very quick question.
It's going
to
be.
You had one more thing.
Here we go. Okay, this is working. For the gal who is interested in being a recording engineer, I'm the same age and I am an acoustics engineer. So that it is possible. But my question is, are the counselors department-wide encouraged to allow clients to sort of, if they come and say, I want to be such and so, I want to be a private investigator using mostly my computer, etc., are the counselors encouraged to solicit that information other than just pigeonholing people into canned programs?
If they're a professional rehabilitation counselor, I would hope that would indeed be the case. I mean, it has to be a collaborative effort between the consumer, the individual who is seeking employment, and our counselors. Our counselors are professionals, and a professional counselor will certainly sit down and talk with the consumer, discuss what the needs are, what are their priorities, what are their strengths, what are their interests, and we'll start working with them on that. But I do not ever want to hear that we are pigeonholing people into jobs, just like I don't want to hear about jobs for the blind. No. If that's happening with somebody, I want to talk with you.
All right. I want to thank you very much for all of your participation. Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
I want to thank Director Sauer for coming here this day to talk with us, to hear our input, as well as Catherine Bales. Kathy will be here both the rest of the day and part of tomorrow, so see her, talk to her. She's certainly shown us through the several times that she's been here already what a real asset to the department that she is. So let's give one more round of applause for Director Sauer and Catherine Bale. Thank you. Okay. I'm really excited to hear our next speaker. I've heard so many incredible things about him from so many of our members down in Southern California. And without any further ado on my part, I'm going to turn it over for an introduction to a gentleman I've known in this movement since about the time I got into it, just about, Ken Metz.
Thank you. I'm going to start out, and thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. I'm going to start out, first of all, by asking you for one time not to applaud. Our speaker is here. He just got his new dog from Seeing Eye yesterday, who's still a little hesitant with some of the applause. So in this case, for once, I'm going to ask you not to applaud when I introduce him or even when he's completed his talk. Our speaker is a sergeant major. He was in Iraq, and that was the way he lost his vision. He's going to be telling you a little bit of his story, but I want you to know that it was interesting because when I first met him, it happened just because the Junior Blind of America has a blind veterans program where we do some local services for the blind veterans down here. And instead of them going to Palo Alto and to other locations, when they want to stay in the local area, we provide a couple of those services. One of the services we started with here was orientation mobility. And as a matter of fact, his O&M instructor through the Junior Blind, Felicia Echevarria, is here with him. Especially because he is new with the Seeing Eye Dog, and in this case I can say Seeing Eye Dog because that's where it's from. But she is here to help out. The school asked her to help because he was the dog was so new. Jesse has an interesting story to tell you, and we wouldn't have learned this if he hadn't come to our program. He got there. He's gone through his O&M. He's going to go through a little more. He's going to be going through some computer training through us. And I'm just telling you the side stuff. He's going to tell you the interesting stuff. He's going to go through some computer training with us. And I won't say where yet. I don't know if Jesse wants it known yet. If it is, he can tell you. But he does have a job to go to after he completes the training. No. Hold on. Thank you. I know how to do that. but, you know, meeting him, talking with him, listening to him, and seeing how he interacted with our other students in our Davidson program and everything as far as talking one-on-one with them and in group sessions, it's a great story for you to hear. So it gives me just a wonderful pleasure and a great pleasure to introduce our speaker, who is here, and he was just came home, and he'll tell you the story from Iraq. I think it's less than a year ago. Sergeant Major Jesse Acosta.
Thank you very much, Ken. Good afternoon to you all here, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here.
Just a little bit from that mic.
Okay. My name is Sergeant Major Jesse Acosta, born in East L.A. and raised in Santa Fe Springs. I've been a member of the United States Armed Forces for over 30 years. I joined fresh out of high school. I think I lost my mic here. Can you hear me? Okay. Fresh out of high school, I joined the military. That was my dream. And to this day, I still serve our country and am proud to be able to be part of the blind community and say I'm still actively in the United States military. A little over a year ago, I was called up to serve my country on the presidential call-up list. And I deployed with a whole group. I was in charge of a battalion. It's okay. And there in country in Iraq, from the day we arrived, we were continuously hit, day in, day out. And this one particular morning, January 16th of 06, that was my lucky day. Unfortunately, I lost my sight, and only my sight, because I haven't lost my vision yet. Well, the good news that follows, of course, is this. Out of the battalion, I was the only one injured. So I'm at peace with that. The road to recovery is tremendous, yes. I'm not going to lie, sit here and lie to you about it. I have numerous surgeries still ahead of me, and I've gone through numerous surgeries just to put me back together. I was hit by a mortar rocket, and I suffered my loss. Nevertheless, during that time of recovery, of course, suffering from traumatic brain injury as well, it was a road of recovery. It took some time, although they seemed fit. I was good to go for rehab in Northern California. Little did they know how much pain I was in, day out, because of my injuries. And due to that, I suffered a tremendous weight loss. But nevertheless, I said, enough. It's time for me to go home and do my healing. Since I didn't have convalescent leave, per the military to start healing, they send me straight to rehab. Well, it didn't pan out. I came home, and during the summer of 06, I started to heal, work out on my own, get back in shape. And one thing led to another. I'm not one to quit. And this was going to be a whole new book in my life, of course. So where do I start? Well, you start at home. You have to heal. And then you start seeking your own assistance as far as what can be done for me, who can help me. Well, West LA VA hooked me up with Junior Blind of America. What a story that has been. A positive one, of course. With that, I wasn't endorsed up in Northern California to go for a dog guide. I said, okay, I'm not going to accept that as an answer, and I'll do what it takes to be able to get my dog so I could walk freely from one place to another, and just to be able to be feel that sense of independency again. So I continuously woke up every day, 7 days a week, nonstop, in my backyard, working out with weights on my own. And at the same time, my consolation to my injuries and having peace at mind, of course, was two pit bulls. And they would, strangely, they would walk side by side me and guide me from the exit of the house to the weights and sit there beside me as I worked out on a daily basis. Now, those dogs were not trained at all, believe me you. All they did was eat and make a mess. So with that, you know, I started off going to 5Ks. I started off with a church function. It was a 5K. And, you know, fresh with my injuries, I didn't do too good. I didn't do too bad. From my first 5K, I attended another 5K. Well, behind my belt, I had two 5Ks, two 10Ks, a half a marathon, and I just recently completed the LA Marathon. Now, mind you, I wasn't fit to have a dog per Northern California Rehab Center. Okay? I wasn't fit, and yet I proved to them that, hey, you're not going to stop me. I'm going to do what it takes to acquire that dog to be independent. Well, so the months went on, and again, like I mentioned earlier, I was introduced to Junior Blind. It was mentioned to me in that summer of 06, and finally, I guess, with all the red tape and details worked out, I was introduced to my orientation mobility specialist, Felicia Faith Echeverria, who's also homegrown from East L.A. I have to add that in there, of course. I'm proud of it. And from there, it was within 3 weeks. It was no time. I was doing 30 miles a day, doing bus routes, doing transfers, and yet I was yet too slow for Northern California. Okay? But it went on. It kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. She endorsed me, approved me going to New Jersey for the CNI to acquire my dog. And as mentioned earlier by Ken, today I have my dog. His name is Charlie, a beautiful German Shepherd. And the feel of independency, of course, is tremendous, you know, and I couldn't be more happier with the steps I've taken, of course. But if it wasn't for a nonprofit organization, Junior Blind of America, where would I be now? You know, I guess I'd be searching or waiting for that time to come to say, okay, you're good to go. That's not going to happen by me. So with that, I would just like to say, well, I don't know if I should tell this story or not. I had another story, but okay. I don't want to hog the system here or what's going on here. But I'm going to tell you this one story that came to me. It was just by happenstance. When I was at a Home Depot acquiring some items for my sister, she was putting in a brand new barbecue system in her backyard in her brand new house in Temecula. So I was consulting with her as far as what she needed to buy to lay down the gas lines and whatnot. We're standing at the cash register, and this lady, I'll never forget her name, is Maureen. She goes, can you see me? And I stood there, and I nudged my nephew who was standing beside me. Is she talking to me? She goes, I think so, Uncle. So she yelled out again, can you see me? And I go, excuse me, ma'am, are you talking to me? She goes, can you see me? I was dumbfounded, and I go, I don't think you understand. I'm holding in my hand a white cane. And she goes, can you see me? One more time. And I said, okay, if by that time, PTSD started to kick in. And I was getting a little bit frustrated. And she goes, well, let me tell you the story. And here's the story. There was Sergeant Major Acosta and we'll say Smitty, who were both veterans in the hospital, what we call the retirement home. Can you hear me now? Sound like Verizon. So, okay. Now you don't really want me to sound off, do you? Okay. So, you know, every morning, Smitty and myself were in our room in the retirement home for soldiers, old soldiers home. And every morning I would wake up, Smitty, how's it look outside this morning, Smitty? He goes, well, Sergeant Major, today we have blue skies, birds are flying, butterflies are landing on branches, and there's a caterpillar on the windowsill. And I said, oh, that must be so beautiful. And these events would go on day in and day out. Smitty, how's the morning today? And he would say, well, Sergeant Major, today it's a little bit overcast. There's still some partly blue skies outside. Birds are still flying. And I could see a bird making a nest in front. And I said, wow. And flies and bugs are just all over the place. And I said, awesome. So, you know, as I said, day in and day out would go, week in, week out, month by month, and year by year, until one day I yelled out, Smitty. I didn't get a reply. So I said, I yelled out again, Smitty. No reply. So I sat there in my bed, you know, quietly until the nurse walked in. And I said, Miss Nurse, is Smitty asleep or what's wrong with him? She goes, no, Sergeant Major. Smitty passed away last night. And we rolled him away. And I sat there quietly and I go, so he passed away? She goes, yes. I go, Nurse, do you mind if you relocate my bed by the window where Smitty used to sleep? And she was real quiet. And she said, the window, Sergeant Major? I go, yes, Miss Nurse. And she stood there. Sergeant Major, there is no window. So I sat there quietly. I go, there's no window? She goes, no. She goes, let me explain to you what Smitty was doing. He knew that you had lost your eyesight during the war. But he also knew you never lost your vision. So with that, never forget, those of us who have lost our sight, we have not lost our vision, and don't ever give up. That's my story. No, that is my story. Thank you very much. Now, I'll tell you what. If you want to applaud, Charlie's underneath the seat right here. He's secured. He's tied down. You go right ahead. Feel free.
We'll be open to a few questions in a few minutes. It's up to you.
I see.
Okay. Jesse has said that he is willing to answer a couple questions if you have them, and we have some time. And so Dan will try to get a mic to you. Am I on? Okay. I'm usually not on, so...
Hi, I'm Terry Almy, and I just want to say something. I'm a rehabilitation counselor, and I'm soon to leave the Department of Rehabilitation, and I have mixed emotions about that, and I'm going to miss it very much because I feel that it's very important to do a good job. But I just want to say that Jesse here was able to help me without me even knowing him. A client of mine... was living in an apartment that was really, it was okay, but the stove didn't really work. And, you know, the Department of Rehab, to my knowledge, I don't know, I've certainly never bought a stove for anybody. But it just so happened that Jesse was able to help my client. I mean, you know, me working and just telling a mobility instructor about it, who's working, Felicia, as a matter of fact, who's working with my client.
Check.
And Jesse came, and he was able to get my client a stove. So isn't that great that we can all work together like that? Thanks, Jesse.
Huh? Okay.
Jeff, this is Marlena. And Jesse, I'm not sure if you know that the California Council of the Blind is streaming its convention on the Internet. And one of our Internet listeners has written in and asked me to expressly say thank you for your service.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Anyone else?
Am I on? Okay, this is Andrea Pitzenbarger, and I want to echo what Marlena just said. Thank you, Jesse, for being there. Unfortunately, I think you're probably one of many people we're going to see in the next few years who have different types of disabilities as a result of this war. My question is this, really quick. Was the lady you saw in the store, was she the nurse? I guess I lost you somewhere, and I wasn't clear what the connection was between the woman who was asking if you could see her and the story of the man that you told.
You're talking about Miss Nurse? Oh, Maureen. She was a cash registered clerk at a Home Depot in Marietta. And how that story came about, I have no idea. But when she introduced it to me, it made a lot of sense. At the time, I was going through trials and tribulations, as I mentioned. I was just newly injured, didn't know what my life was going to be like in this stage. And as you can see, going from having your sight 1 minute and losing it completely the next because of these travesties going on overseas and whatnot, I didn't know what to expect. Emotionally, I was starting to fall apart, but somehow or another, I pulled myself together. And it was, if it wasn't for some of the people that I have met throughout my ordeal since the time I've lost my sight, to be honest, I don't know where I would be, because I, who had my sight at one time, never thought ever in my wildest dream I would wind up with this devastating injury and losing my sight. But little did I know, or little was I educated, as to the blind community could live a normal life. We just got to get out there. We just don't throw your hands up and say, I quit. Don't quit. You know, it's changed my life, yes, but at the same time, it's made me completely more aggressive to seek some different avenues, some better technology for us out there, and things of that nature. And it's out there, believe me, we just got to be able to tap into the source. And, you know, sometimes, yes, we run into road barriers, some speed bumps, and say, well, that doesn't fit our budget. I'll tell you what. California is one of the richest states in the nation. How come we can't meet that budget? But nevertheless, again, don't give up.
Okay. Anyone else?
I guess I'm next. I have a mic. I just want to say, Jesse, thank you so much for your story and your courage. I mean, you could have gone away somewhere and just given up. But you didn't give up, and I just thank you so much for your story. And I echo what that writer wrote in, which is thank you, thank you, thank you for your service.
You're welcome. Thank you for your support as well.
Jesse, this is Mitch Pomerantz. We met at the East LA fundraiser a couple of months back. And what? And Jesse, hopefully Ken will get you in touch with a gentleman named John Fleming, or Ken will get you in touch with me, and I'll get you in touch with John. John is an ex-naval paratrooper who still skydives, who's totally blind, and John is the president of our veterans affiliate, our national veterans affiliate, VIVA. And I think you would be a tremendous asset to that affiliate. And so I hope that I can hear from you shortly. I'll get you in touch with John. He's up in Oregon. He's a great guy. We'd love to get you involved with VIVA, Visually Impaired Veterans of America. I knew I'd get it out eventually. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mitch. I'm looking forward to that because this is not only I'm not here out for myself as well. And I'm also, I've been in the news, all TV stations, in the newspaper, Orange County Register, CNN, and some magazines. From here on, I'm also going to be an advocate for those coming back from the war with injuries. And, of course, one of my specialties, I hope to be able to guide them, those who come losing their sight as well. So in any way, if we can touch bases, that would be awesome, Mitch. Thank you.
Mr. President, I'd like to make a motion, if it's okay. I'd like to make a motion that we make Sergeant Major Jesse honorary member of California Council of Vine.
He's already a member.
No such motion is out of order. And if anybody wants to appeal the ruling of the chair, just try it.
That's great. Jesse, it's Ken. Just wanted to follow up a little bit, and I don't know, you know, how much you would want to go into this, and I don't mean that it needs a whole lot, but just if you could give just a minute or two about how things occurred when you came back. I know you spoke about going up north, but I wanted to find out if you could talk just a little bit about things that might have happened at Walter Reed, or if you're free to, or at Palo Alto, that made you change your mind and find a new opening down here.
Absolutely, Ken. Excuse me. Well, from the time I got hit on January 16th, I went through the system, of course. They saved my life in Balad, Iraq. From there, after going 10 hours extensive surgery to put me somewhat back together and stabilize me, they flew me out the following day, ASAP, to Landstuhl, Germany. There I stood 4 days on recovery, not realizing exactly what had happened to me, of course, because of the injuries and the TBI that I had suffered. To be honest with you, I didn't know that I had lost my sight. And on top of that, I didn't know if I had lost some limbs. So as I gradually came to, of course, I wouldn't ask the doctor. I don't know if he was trying to, you know, throw me some curveballs and whatnot. So I started asking the nurses, can you describe my injuries? And all they can describe was the head injury that I had sustained and, of course, some shrapnel along my body. But that somewhat eased me a bit, knowing that I still had some legs, some arms. And I said, okay, so let's see what else is next. Well, from Landstuhl, Germany, after breaking the news to me that I wouldn't have any sight, they flew me to Walter Reed. In Walter Reed, I stood there as an inpatient 3 days. And they would have made me an outpatient a lot sooner, except for they screwed up somehow or another the transportation for my children and my spouse to go and greet me. So once they arrived, they made me an outpatient and had me what's called the Malone House. And I would have to go and see them now and then, but I don't recall any of that stuff. What I do recall is that the last visit I had in Walter Reed, it was a dentist I saw for a checkup. And knowing that I had the palate blown out in my teeth as well, I asked them, when are they going to start working on me so they could do some dental implants? And the only thing I recall, the answer was, implants? You don't qualify for implants. Well, that was the beginning of my love story with Walter Reed. So from that point on, they shipped me out straight February 8th to Palo Alto, VA, Northern California. That's why I mentioned Northern California. That's where I was, Palo Alto. Now, place yourself in my situation, if you will. You get hit by a bomb. You lose your sight. You suffer from TBI. You had your palate blown out, your teeth blown out. You have a fractured right mandible. Your medial walls on your nasal, on your nose, have been blown out as well. They sent me to Northern California to go through the Western Blind Rehab Center there in that condition. Well, as I had mentioned earlier, I suffered a weight loss tremendously. I lost 40 pounds in no time. So it was like I couldn't eat, couldn't consume anything, suffering from massive headaches because of the injuries on a daily basis, and it was cold in the winter. So do you think I was in the right place to retain information to learn how to walk? Absolutely not. So therefore, in the reports, I was extremely slow in retaining or not retaining at all, and therefore they wouldn't endorse me for my dog. And that was my thing. Well, if I'm going to be blind, I want to be independent and somehow walk freely on my own and acquire this dog. So as you can see, I left with another love story up in Northern California, and I've been pretty well somewhat disgusted with the system down there, and I'll tell you why. And it's no secret, it's out in the media. When I arrived there, I felt like I was a project. Here we have this blind, newly blind soldier from the battlefield. Let's start from ground zero, which I'm sure their intent was all well. But how are they going to do that with my injuries? You know, so at the same token, you know, once I started gradually to wake up from my TBI, and I say that because I'm the one who lived through it, I woke up and asked them, when are you guys going to graduate me out of this place and so I could get my dog? At that point in time, it was mid-May. We will not endorse you for a dog, and you are to stay here till the end of the summertime. I said, really? Then you're going to have to explain to the Department of the Army what I'm doing home, because I'm leaving. I'm not going to stay here any longer. And that was my plight. From that point on, I came home in the summer, the beginning of June. And that's when I started to get in contact with the West LA VA. Jane Merrill, who's my VIS coordinator there. Well, if you know her, go ahead and clap. She's an awesome lady, you know. She's the one who put me in contact, and she said, well, there is another school we could send you to in Tucson, Arizona. And I said, I don't think you understood what I said, ma'am. I'm not going to go to any other VA facility again. So if there's anything nearby or if you know of a school that I could attend, she goes, I do. It's in West LA. It's called Junior Blind of America. Well, that still hadn't soaked in yet. But I said, okay, would you like to stay there? And I go, no. I want to be able to go home and heal. Will they do like an outpatient kind of thing with me? I didn't know what words to use. She said, yeah, if you can find a ride to go there every day. And I go, well, I think I can do that. My spouse had quit her job to attend to my injuries and whatnot and make all the doctor appointments as of this date. So there was somewhat of a loss of income there. But nevertheless, due to my status in the military, we've been okay, been able to survive. So the inception of the Junior Blind of America came thanks to the VA in Northern California doing what they did. I was introduced to the Junior Blind down here in Southern California, who have done an awesome and tremendous job, not only in educating me as far as the O&M goes, but also introducing me with the latest technology by some of the computer whizzes, and not to disregard or leave an individual who's been instrumental in somewhat helping me in my growth. His name is Louis Herrera. I mean, once he, told me his story that he at one time worked for Department of Defense designing a smart bomb, I said, if this guy could do it being blind, how come I can't continue on with my life and adhere to some of these things that are going on the outside and be up on technology? Well, you know, I've been blessed to be surrounded by some of these individuals, and that's what has really inspired me and pulled me out of my rut. So, I mean, here we are, you know. What do we want to do, and who do we want to be? Reach for the stars. Stars are bright.
Okay, we're going to have we could go on the whole rest of the session, but we're going to have two very quick comments, and then we're going to have to move on. This is truly incredible.
Okay, Jesse, my name's Jason, and after hearing what you just said, how would you feel about writing a book? Sounds good.
Well, I don't have a problem with it. I don't know how to write, though. I'm still going through the process, believe me, you. And also a movie's been introduced to see if I want a movie to be made on my story. You know, I'm all open to, if it's going to do good for our community, I'm here for you.
President Jeff.
Yes, Warren.
What is the cost of lifetime membership?
What is the cost of what? The cost of a lifetime membership is $200.
I have a proposal. Hawaii has come here with a proposal that Hawaii and California foster a sister affiliate relationship. And maybe the good Sergeant Major Acosta would be willing to be the glue to this project, hopefully a long-term project. And with the exchange of people from California to Hawaii and Hawaii to California. I propose that we tender to Jesse a lifetime membership to the California Council of the Blind, and Hawaii pay half and CCB pay half.
What do you think, Jesse? You want us?
Mr. President.
Oh, sorry.
But I propose that this motion be made with ability to our convention. Wait.
You want to take your lovely wife to the lovely land of Oahu in March 2008, Jesse?
I'm there already.
All right. Is there any opposition to this motion? All right. All those in favor say aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Outstanding, Warren. You're on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, this has truly been inspirational, and above and beyond that, the only thing I'm going to say is we may have some issues to attack on treatment of wounded veterans by this country, so let's get out there and help Jesse do something. Okay, let's hear it one more time for Jesse Acosta.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I'm very, very impressed.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. I have to find the every act after this is going to be difficult to follow. Okay, we are very pleased. Gene Lozano did some hard work. We're very pleased to have our next guest with us to tell us about some of the work that Greyhound Lines is doing in access services for its blind and visually impaired customers. We have with us today Mr. Russell Haynes. And Mr. Haynes is a senior supervisor in the ADA compliance department of Greyhound Lines, Incorporated. He is also a faculty member in the Department of Psychology of El Centro College in Dallas, Texas. And Mr. Haynes has worked extensively with the disability community since 1991 in a variety of environments. And with that, I want to introduce to you, and thank you very much to Greyhound for having him attend our convention, Mr. Russell Haynes.
Okay, thank you for the warm welcome. And I want to say
thank you, sir.
I'm going to try that one.
Yes, I want to say thank you for that warm welcome. And after Sergeant Major Custer's presentation, this is going to be a hard, hard act to follow. And I do say a special appreciation for our armed services and wonderful men in uniform. And I'd like to give another round of applause to Sergeant Major Custer. Okay. One of the things that, as I said, my name is Russell Haynes, and I'm with the Greyhound ADA Compliance Department. And what we are going to talk a little bit about today is the continued effort of Greyhound as a company to continue to aid customers who are customers with disabilities in continuing that independence that I've heard the theme over and over since I've been here listening. One of the things that Greyhound Alliance has done is in 1999 we established the ADA Compliance Department. The intent of the company was to fully comply with the department DOT regulations and to proactively implement service-based operations. This service-based operation is intended to provide the highest quality service to persons with disabilities, and we're wanting to make that consistent with Greyhound's primary mission of providing accessible and affordable transportation to customers. To accomplish this goal, one of the things that Greyhound did is we put together the Greyhound Advisory Commission. And this committee that we put together is comprised of persons with disabilities and representatives of groups representing persons with disabilities. Examples of those individuals would be the Paralyzed Veterans Association, the National Organization on Disabilities, and I would like to say we're very pleased and privileged to have your esteemed Mr. Gene Lozano serve on our advisory committee. And what we do on this committee is we basically encourage the committee members to be the voice of their constituents and let us know the things that we can do as a company to continue to improve the services that we provide and to do things that would be in the best interest of our customers, especially customers with disabilities. Over the past few years, and with changes in management, Greyhound has undertaken some major initiatives designed to improve services and return to that icon that most of you knew from back in the day. All right. Some of the major initiatives that we have undertaken is a program by the name, one of them is a program by the name of Elevate Everything. And Elevate Everything is a program designed to remake all of our company-owned terminals nationally. We basically went ahead and what we called did a facelift. We did things like improved pathways, worked on disability-related issues in terms of accessibility. All right. One of the other things as part of that program is we developed a program called the CARE program. And the CARE program is a program that every Greyhound employee has been trained on. And this is a new program that we're rolling out. And I just want to take a minute to tell you what the word CARE stands for in the Greyhound world.
The first letter, C, basically says we want to ensure that our employees demonstrate courtesy. Basically, we want good old-fashioned manners. We want to get back to when we see our customers, we greet them with hello, good morning, hi, and what can we do to help you? The next word, the next letter in the word is appearance. We have renovated all of our company-owned terminals. We have refurbished our buses. We have provided our employees with new uniforms. And management has also done management uniforms. And we also talked to them about their personal appearance in terms of how they carry themselves when they're on the job. The R in care stands for respect. And with this group, I think that is a very key element because we all demand respect. So as Greyhound sees it, we want our employees to show respect to all of our customers, and we encourage even greater respect with our customers with disabilities. The last letter is excellence. And we encourage our employees to go above and beyond when they're assisting customers. So to make it short, we basically say we care about our customers, which is every member of this organization and members in this room. Another program that we have implemented is the PLEASE program, and the PLEASE program is designed to deal with conflict resolutions, as when you're dealing with the public, you know, ultimately you will have some conflict. And the PLEASE program, again, is patience, listening, empathy, acknowledging, solving, and basically end it right. So we have all of our employees trained on this program. There are also programs we have developed to ensure that our employees are doing the things that we say they should be doing. One of those programs is the Mystery Shopper program, and this program is basically conducted by former drivers, retired employees, and individuals who understand Greyhound policy. And the basic objective of this program is to make sure that our employees are following company policy. One of the programs that has evolved out of the Elevate Everything program is a new program we have. It's called the Mystery Traveler. And everyone in this room who is interested in doing this program, the way you can get to be part of our Mystery Traveler program is by purchasing tickets on the internet or online. The online system will choose individuals randomly to provide feedback about the experience they have on Greyhound. So those of you who are interested in providing feedback, then you could purchase tickets online, and that will be the way you will be able to get into that program. The next program we have is the Mystery Rider program, and we have an external company that provides us the information as to what our employees are actually doing. So one of the things we try to do is we try to get feedback on a regular basis. The one thing we do have as a company is the support and the commitment from the management to implement recommendations made by the committee. The committee that I referred to again is the Greyhound Advisory Committee, and this committee meets every 2 years, And we are in contact with members of this committee on a need, on an individual basis, where they will provide us feedback based on information they're getting from their constituents. And again, we are always anxious to receive feedback, and we will make any reasonable change that will aid us in improving our services to the disability community. Customers wishing to request assistance during their travel should contact our Greyhound Travel Assistance Group. And this group is specifically designed to aid customers with disabilities and answer questions that you would have. And this group can be reached at our toll-free number of 1-800-752-4841. And I do have some pamphlets that will provide additional information as to how you guys can request assistance from us as a company. The number is 1-800-752-4841. We would like to make sure that you're aware that this is only a recommendation and it is not a requirement that you call this number. Unless, of course, the individual is requiring an accessible bus, then we urge you to give us a call a minimum of 48 hours advance of your travel so that we would be able to have that equipment in place for your convenience. Now, one of the things I'd like to say here is that Greyhound is acutely aware of that old adage. And that adage says that 10% of your employees will create 90% of your problems. With that in mind, the ADA Compliance Department is available to answer any concerns that a customer with a disability has regarding a potential violation of company policies involving disability-related issues. Now, we can be reached at our number of 1-800-755-2357. And unlike the other parts of the company, you will be able to call and you would get a telephone agent. The ADA Compliance Department is the only department in the company that when you call that number, the person you're getting is going to be a person that can actually resolve the issue. And there will be many a days that if someone calls the office, I will answer that phone. Right, because I do answer that phone, and there are three members in the department, and we all have the authority to do what it takes to take care of our customers with disabilities. So we understand that, and we take that very seriously. That department is designed to conduct investigations of any issue that is brought to us. We share information with the employees' management. So when there's an issue, it goes directly to the management of that particular facility that the issue is reported. And we usually have great influence when we hear something that is disturbing or, as I say, that meets that criteria of that old adage. Okay. Corrective action is usually taken based on the results of our investigations. One of the things we also say is that the ADA Compliance Department for Greyhound is as responsive a department as you're going to get. We work very hard at being responsive to your needs. We work very hard at trying to understand what we can do better to make your travel and your independence as individuals better. So should you guys have questions, concerns, issues, please feel free to give us a call. I do thank Mr. Lozano for the invitation to come and speak to you. And at this point, I would like to open the floor should you guys have questions that I can address.
Yes, I actually have. This is Ken. I have a comment. I had a student where I work who had some difficulty with a driver. And this is a good comment, by the way. Not at first, but it ended up very well, so I do want to thank you for that. I ended up calling your ADA office and spoke to a gentleman. He was kind enough to start an investigation. He actually reversed the guy's charges so that he got a free ride that weekend. And the following week, the guy ended up on the same route going back home down to, I can't remember exactly, El Centro or somewhere down that way. And he ended up with the same driver and he had the same incident. And that driver has not been out since then. So your folks took wonderful care of him, and it was an issue with a guide dog, as a matter of fact, where they wanted him to go to the back of the bus.
Right. Can you tell me how long ago this was?
It was probably 4 months ago.
Okay.
And I really appreciated
I have a suspicion I know about that issue.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to thank you for the quickness in which it was handled.
And one of the things that we have, and just address that, we have this issue on an ongoing basis. Some individuals are afraid of animals, and they have that knee-jerk reaction, and we need to correct that and make sure that we get the information about that.
Beryl Brown from the Redwood Empire chapter. One of the concerns of the blind and visually impaired and other disabled is the availability of transportation. And one of the things that's been happening with Greyhound is the discontinuing of some of the rural routes. Can you speak to that?
Okay. One of the things that has happened, and most people are aware, that there has been a major downsize within Greyhound, especially with the rural routes. Now, what has happened with that is a number of smaller outlying companies now interline with Greyhound. And what we do is we serve as the major company that will do the major hubs, and these smaller companies like Crucero will now do the rural routes. And even when we did the downsizing, what they have done is they have moved just to the next major location so people can get to the next location and leave from there.
In your sensitivity training program, do you train your employees how to work with blind people that use service dogs?
Yes, that is part of our training program. Every Greyhound driver goes through an 8-hour training program specifically to deal with customers with disabilities. And that training is an ongoing process. And should we have a problem with an employee or an employee has questions, they can get assistance from our department, and they can also get additional training from the training department.
My name is Alice Parkinson, and my question is, is it possible for a person with a walker to travel by Greyhound?
A person with a what?
Walker.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
All right. If a customer is traveling with an assist device, that customer is welcome to travel with one assist device per disability at no cost.
Hi, my name is Bill Powers, and my question relates to the website for booking trips.
Yes, sir.
I'm a partially sighted person, and I find that the Greyhound website is not very readable for somebody with low vision. I'd encourage you to have your web developer come up with a better way to navigate the site. There are far too many drop-down windows, far too much small print. It's a very busy-looking site, and just not really that navigatable unless you are able to have some sighted assistance.
Okay. I will definitely take that information back, but one of the things I do know is that we have worked very hard with our web developers to get the software piece of it, and as a matter of fact, I was talking to one student, a blind student that was using JAWS last week, and he was reporting to us that he was having all the information that he needed, and he was having a good experience with it. So for the most part, I've gotten good reaction to the website, but I will definitely take your statement back to our developers.
Mr. Haynes, my name is Doug Martin. You and I have spoken by phone with respect to specific incidents at the San Bernardino terminal. But I want to bring something with regard to that, our destroyed luggage, still we don't have back. But anyway, what I wanted to bring to your attention is that, well, my girlfriend and I took a 60-day Ameripass trip all over the country, about 6,000 miles. In the city of Denver, Colorado, which is home to one of the rival organizations to ours, we were told by no less than three customer service representatives that the word blind would not be used in their presence. Could you check up on that, please?
Oh, I definitely will.
I'm Winifred Downing from San Francisco. In San Francisco, when one is delivered by a cab to the Greyhound station, that is two floors below the floor that has the ticket counter on it. There are a great many homeless people, let's say, around down there. Frequently, the elevator that goes from the first to the third floor is out of commission, but a blind person has no way of knowing that since they can't read the sign. So I have called ahead of time and asked if someone from security could come down when I have come with a cab. I will call them on a cell phone and meet me to get me to the third floor. And I am told that, no, that since that's not Greyhound property, they won't do that. Now, how then do we get to buy the ticket and get on the bus?
Okay. And they're telling you because it's not Greyhound property?
It's not their property. The bottom floor does not belong to Greyhound.
Okay.
The place where the cab draws up does not belong to Greyhound.
Okay. And now, one of the things that we have to pay to get involved with here is whether or not we do have the right to go into that area. And that is something I would have to follow up to see exactly what procedure they have with the building owner as to how they're going to accommodate our customers with disabilities. And you said this is in the San Francisco terminal?
San Francisco Bay terminal.
Okay. I'll definitely get with the manager on that particular issue.
Is a problem. I have the same problem. Friends Bay.
Yeah.
I just gave him the information.
It's the main San Francisco terminal.
Thank you very much. My name is Don Roberts, and I have a question for you, sir. I have taken several trips on Greyhound, and I respect the necessity of maintaining schedules whenever possible. It has always been my concern as a blind traveler that because when you get off, everybody else can race ahead, you know, at the lunch stop breaks and get their orders placed first, etc. I'm wondering if you care to address what specific instructions are given to drivers as to making certain that that the blind passengers are back on the bus at the time of departure. I've never been left, and I'm not alleging that, but I've certainly had some anxious moments.
Again, that is a good concern because that happens to most customers who are blind that are traveling independently. Our drivers are trained to assist each customer with a disability based on what their needs are. So the blind customer, again, will need to to ensure that they can get back to the bus before the bus leaves. So all of our drivers are specifically trained with respect to assisting our blind customers with getting them back to not just the bus, but the correct bus. You'd be surprised how many times people at a bus stop with four buses get on the wrong bus. And I am not talking about the blind customer, I'm talking about the regular customer.
Yes, I have a question, but I also have a comment regarding that too. Because I travel with a friend who has a seeing eye dog, and I know sometimes when we have that 30-minute break, we get off the bus, we have to rush over to McDonald's, try and get our food, try and use the restroom, and let the dog do his business.
Right.
And trying to do that within 30 minutes when there's 50, 60 other people trying to do the same, at least get their food. They don't have dogs to do their business. But, you know, sometimes you just don't have enough time, and it gets very stressful wondering if you're going to miss your bus while you're trying to take care of business.
Okay.
So
one of the things I would say to you, and this is federal law I'm going to quote here. The federal law says if you make a reasonable request for additional time based on your needs, as a company, we are required to provide that additional time. So please, if you are in such a situation, make sure you request additional time from the driver so that you can get what you need to get.
Okay, well, that's great. I'll keep that in mind for the future. My question, though, was, does Greyhound have any plans in the future to make it a little more accommodating for those travelers with seeing eye dogs or service animals? Because I know when we travel, the dog, since they put the protective device between the driver and that first disabled seat, there's no leg room there at all. Mm-hmm. And there's very little on the other side, on the passenger side. So you usually have to stuff the dog under a chair, under your seat. And half the time, your dog's tail, foot, leg is sitting out behind in the into the aisle or the row behind you, mm-hmm. where the person behind there is either walking over, standing on, stepping on your dog.
Right.
Is there any possibilities that Greyhound might make it some sort of accommodation somehow to make a little more room or a little more accessible for someone with a service animal?
Actually, the only thing we would be able to do in that particular case is talk to the bus manufacturers. I do know that we're looking right now at purchasing some new buses. I could not tell you what design they're actually going to get because the buses are designed to meet the federal regulations and the federal standards. So for us to modify that, I don't know if we can.
Mr. Haynes, I want to follow up an earlier question and bring on another question after that. Perhaps here in California, there are smaller bus companies that are picking up the slack, but I'm hearing from my constituents in Florida and in West Virginia who have absolutely no bus service of any kind. And beyond that, when the downsizing occurred, Amtrak obviously also serves rural areas. Did Greyhound and Amtrak make any attempt to work together? And I know they're a federal agency, basically. But was any attempt to coordinate routes and schedules when the downsizing occurred? Because it sure, at least given what I'm hearing, doesn't appear as if that's the case.
I am not aware of any discussions between Amtrak and Greyhound. But one of the things that we want to make sure that it's clear as to the areas that were selected for downsizing. One of the criteria for downsizing an area was the fact that we had little or no passengers coming out of that area. It was in such a state where we had schedules going in, and for a 365-day calendar year, we had less than 40 people boarding at that area. So it really was a math equation as to whether or not it is a location that we wanted to keep open. And one of the things that I'm sure a lot of you are aware of is based on our current economic environment and after 9/11, travel has taken a major hit. The travel industry is just starting to regroup, and we had to make some very tough decisions.
Okay, I want to thank Mr. Haynes. I know there's probably more questioners out there, but thank you very much. A lot of great questions, great information that you've provided. Mr. Haynes, you want to give that phone number one more time that people can call?
Okay, our phone number is 1-800-755-2357, and that is for the Greyhound ADA Compliance Department. Mm-hmm. And our travel assistance group, their number is 1-800-752-4841.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
And I do have some pamphlets that I would leave out at the registration table, so if anyone would like to get some. And this is a pamphlet that tells you about all of the services that we provide as a company for customers with disabilities.
Great, thank you. Okay. We'll worry about that. We'll find out more about that later. Because we are running late. Will our last speaker come up to the front from the city of Los Angeles? You know, home ownership is really the American dream in many ways. For those of us who are fortunate, it may be a curse sometimes, but it's really a blessing in others. For many others of us, it is something that we want to attain in the worst way. From the City of Los Angeles Housing Authority to speak on home ownership programs for those with low incomes, we have Lorena Guardado. Lorena, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for letting me be here today and give you some information about what the Housing Authority is doing in terms of home ownership for Section 8 participants. The home ownership program is basically a program with the main goal or objective to assist families who are currently in Section 8 to become independent. The way the program works is very similar to what the Section 8 voucher program is, in the sense that if you qualify, you can use your voucher to purchase a home, but you must be a Section 8 participant. The way the program actually, works is that it allows you to switch from rental assistance to mortgage assistance in order for you to meet your mortgage expenses. By qualifying for the homeownership program, it doesn't mean that the Housing Authority has houses available through the Housing Authority or that we are lending clients money to purchase a home. What it does is, if you qualify, the Housing Authority will determine if you're eligible to receive a subsidy towards your mortgage payment. So I just want to make sure that that's clear, because sometimes many times that's a misunderstanding that clients believe that HACLA has houses, that we are building houses, or that we're direct lenders, and that's not the case. What we are determining with the homeownership is to see if you're still qualified to receive a subsidy towards home ownership. In order to qualify for the home ownership, you must be a current Section 8 participant who is enrolled in the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. The Family Self-Sufficiency Program is basically a program that is geared towards assisting families become independent of all public assistance, including Section 8, through employment or job training. So that's one group of people that can participate in the homeownership program. The next group of people that can participate are families who have been determined to be or qualify as elderly or disabled families. If you're an elderly or disabled family, you can also participate in the homeownership program. And that will be the second group. The third group that can participate are current residents of public housing, and those are people who live in the projects. they can also participate in the homeownership program as long as they're participating in what is called the ROS program. The next group and the final group that can participate in the homeownership without having to be in Section 8 are families who have been displaced due to a government action or a school district. I don't know if you remember a while back that the school district was building new schools, and they were taking control of, private properties or buying a lot of the properties, and families were forced to move out of those neighborhoods. So those families were able to receive Section 8 assistance. So the only group, just to clarify, that can go through the home ownership program without having to be in Section 8 are families who have been displaced by a government action or school district. If you fall under one of these categories, you can participate in the program, but you must also meet the other requirements of the program. And those are that you must not owe any money to the housing authority or any housing authority throughout the country. You must also meet the minimum income requirement, which right now is $15,600. You must also have a FICO score of at least 620. Let me see. You must also have one adult household member who has been employed continuously at least for 1 year. And this is only, I'm giving you the general information about the program, about how the program works. The employment requirement obviously is not required of families who are senior citizens or disabled. But the income requirement is. You still must meet the minimum income requirement of $15,600, and it can be, from different incomes. I mean, it could be SSI, so it's combined income, but still it has to be met, the minimum income requirement. You must also be a first-time home buyer. You must attend a pre-purchase and post-purchase home ownership counseling class. And this is also to ensure that you really understand what home ownership is. A lot of times, we get so excited about being homeowners that we don't realize that we really need to prepare. We really need to understand what the process is, how we can be informed so we know what the right questions are. We know what we ask of the lender. We know what to ask of the realtor. So we want to be informed. So that's the purpose of you having to go through a pre-purchase and post-purchase counseling class. The counseling class is usually 8 hours, and it must be by a HUD-approved counseling agency. And usually at the end of the class, and that's not usually, actually, at the end of the class, you have to receive a certificate stating that you did attend the class, and that's one of the requirements also, that you must have that certificate. The other requirement, this is also very important, that a lot of times we get really excited that we want to be homeowners, and we do it at any cost. We don't really sometimes pay attention whether we can afford it or not. So one of the requirements is that your monthly homeownership expenses cannot exceed 60% of your monthly adjusted income. So that's also important, so that you're able to afford homeownership, that you're not getting into something that, you're going to end up losing. So if you meet the requirements that I just outlined, then you can contact HACLA, the Section 8 advisor who's handling right now the homeownership program, and you ask to participate in the homeownership orientation. The HACLA employee will do a pre-screening to make sure that you meet all the requirements. Income requirements, that you are a current Section 8 participant. So we do a pre-screening over the phone before you are invited to the homeownership orientation. Once you go through the orientation, at that time we go over the same information that I'm going over right now to make sure that you do understand the process. And at the end of the orientation, we make sure that you are really willing, able, and understand what it means to participate in the home ownership program. And if you still want to go through the process, then we will give you a referral to one of the home ownership counseling agencies for you to go and take the pre-purchase counseling class. The counseling agency is responsible for evaluating your credit, for determining what you need to be doing, or what are the requirements for you to prepare to become a homeowner. And they can help, and it is their responsibility to help you fix your credit if there are credit issues. Because, you see, with the homeownership, you have to meet the requirements of the lenders just like everybody else. You have to have good credit. It's based on your income also. So the credit counseling agency will help you with that. And to continue the process, once you have gone through the counseling agency and you come back to Hagline, you say, okay, I went through the homeownership counseling class. I'm ready. I have my certificate here with me. Then what you do is then you're going to have an interview with the Hagline employee to determine whether you meet the income requirements. And if you do meet the income requirements, then the Section A advisor or the homeownership staff will give you a Dear Lender letter or a HAB letter. And that letter basically says, if this family or this individual is given a loan, then the housing authority will assist this family with this amount of or with this much monthly. So basically, what we're telling the bank, if you give this person a loan, this is how much the housing authority will contribute to the monthly payment. So once you have that, then you will go through the bank, get pre-qualified for a loan. If you do get qualified for a loan, the bank will determine, obviously, based on your income, your credit, how much you're qualified for, and then you start the process of looking for a house. It is your responsibility to find a realtor to make sure that you do the research in terms of, the realtor that you're going to be using. And it is, like I said before, it's really important. There are two key things. The person that you choose that will help you find a house, the person that will help you with the loan, all of those are key factors that if you're well-informed, you really are going to be able to take advantage of, the different resources that are available out there. Once you have gone through the process of searching for a home and you found a home, then you immediately notify Hagla that you have found a home. And one of the requirements is also that you must conduct two inspections. One inspection is conducted by Hagla, and the other inspection must be an independent inspection that you, as the interested party in becoming a homeowner, is responsible. And this is also to make sure that what you're getting, that you know what you're getting into, that you know that the house that you chose is worth what the seller is asking, that it doesn't have structural problems, that, you want to, protect yourself at all levels. So once it has gone through the inspection process and the property passes inspections, then you go into the escrow process. And the escrow process is the same thing. Once you sign the paperwork with the seller and the lender, you need to make sure that you notify Hagla that you're going through that stage of the process. So at all levels, you must let Hagla know what you're doing. So we make sure that, the lender also, the lender that you choose is a Hagla-approved lender, because most of the issues that we're having with this program right now are that a lot of the lenders, they have a problem with taking two payments, the payment that the housing authority has or gives to the lender and the payment that you as the owner will give to the lender. So you have to, once you find your lender, once you have, you have been pre-approved for a loan, you must also go back to Hagla and say, okay, is this lender approved by Hagla? So that's the program itself. In general, that's how the program works. It helps families with a monthly subsidy towards purchasing their home. It does not provide homes directly through us. It does not provide, financing through us. It's just like the regular Section 8 program. It provides a subsidy for families to use toward their monthly mortgage expenses. Okay. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. And I also brought some handouts, and they're out there with the same information that I'm providing for you today. And I have the contact numbers over there for you also. If you have any other questions, just feel free to give us a call. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Do we have any questions for Lorena?
Excuse me? Most housing authorities, they have their own homeownership program. It is not mandatory, but a lot of housing authorities, they do have a homeownership program. So it is nationwide. But, I mean, it is not mandatory that every housing authority must have it. But there is a push right now for families to become self-sufficient. So that's also that a lot of housing authorities are becoming involved in having or are deciding to have a homeownership program.
Question.
Yes.
Are there any considerations for Section 8 homeowners who are displaced by natural disaster or accidental disaster?
Right now, based on the current regulations, it's only for families that are being displaced by a government agency. And that's like the example that I gave you with the school districts. It may come in the future, but right now, no.
You probably already mentioned this, but I didn't hear this. As a disabled person, do I need to qualify for Section 8 housing to be privy to this program, or can I, you know, not qualify for Section 8?
You have to be in Section 8. So for the senior citizen or disabled family, you have to be also a current Section 8 participant. The only ones that don't have to be in Section 8 are families who have been displaced or by either a government agency or school district. Those don't have to be in Section 8 in order to participate or qualify for the homeownership program. Any other questions?
Yes. I have just recently relocated here, and because I don't have an income right now, what in the world do single people do? You always hear about families, but you never hear about what single people qualifications are or if they have any.
Well, Section 8 is both families and single individuals. As long as you qualify for Section 8 and you're currently in Section 8, you can and you met all the other requirements that I outlined, you can see if you qualify for the homeownership too. It's not only families. Section 8 in general is for both families and individuals, single individuals. Yes?
Talking about Section 8, houses are allowed to tell you that you cannot, they do not accept Section 8? Like, in other words, if I want to move into a house that's rent and I have Section 8, the owner can say, we don't accept that?
Yes, the owner has a choice. That's why they're privately owned the property. So they have a choice to say, oh, no, we don't want Section 8. They don't have a choice to discriminate, because of religion, origin, and all those other, categories, but they can choose not to participate in the Section 8 program.
Okay.
I understand that with 60% of your income, if you're making SSI 850 a month, then you are around 400 a month maximum income. What house can you buy where your mortgage is $400 a month?
And you're right. Those are the challenges that we're facing. Just everyone in general. Home prices here in California, are crazy. Most working people cannot afford to be homeowners. Right now, the only thing that I can tell you is that there are nonprofit organizations the department, I'm not going to give you the correct, LAHD has some funding, and please check with them directly. I don't want you to go back there and tell them, okay, somebody from HACLA sent me over here. But some agency, and the lender will be the best person to let you know, have funding for the down payment. And usually what it is a silent second, which you don't have to pay until, you finish paying off the loan, or you sell the property.
Where do you go to find out if you qualify for Section 8?
For Section 8 right now, our waiting list is closed. We're not accepting new applicants. So, and that's something that is based on funding. I mean, as you know, funding across the board has been cut. I mean, most of the social programs, I mean, for the last, six years have been, reduced. I mean, their funding has drastically reduced. And Section 8 is not an exception.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
Somebody I know that financially, each, you know, you said the guidelines, $15,000 something a year to be qualified. If a person has that kind of income and they're not on Section 8 because of having too much money to be in like CDs or something, to be eligible for Section 8, where do they go?
Okay, I didn't follow your question. Your question is?
If someone financially qualifies each for the year, say the $15,000 a year, and that's all that the person gets, but for other reasons they cannot get on Section 8, or the list is too long to even get on it, 10 years, whatever, where do they go to apply if they wanted to buy a house?
A lot of cities, they have first-time home buyers programs, and my recommendation would be, is to go to their websites. I did some research there, and there are some cities that they have funding for first-time home buyers. Also, a good resource is to check, HUD's website just to see what's out there. But unfortunately, through Section 8, right now our waiting list is closed. And the other form is to get housing, if you're in need, is to go to public housing, which basically is the projects. Those, the process is there. It takes time too, but it's there. But Section 8, and I want to make sure that that's clear. I don't want to mislead you in thinking, there is a possibility to get Section 8. Section 8 is closed, and the homeownership is for Section 8 participants, and the only category that could get into the homeownership program without having to be in Section 8 are those families that I mentioned to you before that have been displaced due to a government action or school district. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment, Lorena. What is currently being considered now in Congress is a Section 8 Rental Simplification Act that may give some relief to individuals that are on the waiting list and those that may be interested in first, as you said, qualifying for a voucher in order to take advantage of homeownership. There's a Rental Simplification Act is being considered now in Congress that may allow, if it passes both houses, and it's looking like it will in the House, that it will allow local housing authorities to have more flexibility in determining the way in which they administer the voucher. In other words, part of the act will allow housing authorities to have the flexibility to determine limits on the duration and time that families can be issued the voucher. In other words, there's a feeling that it may better serve more of the citizenry if the voucher could be limited in some sense to maybe a 5-year voucher or a 10-year voucher. Currently, as it is, once voucher holders get vouchers, they can retain that voucher throughout their entire lives. And I think there's a feeling that the voucher should be a temporary assistance step for families to get themselves kind of up and going. And then after maybe a term of, just say I think they're considering 5 years or so, then they would have resources and opportunities to kind of get themselves, in some cases, those that are able to, get themselves in a situation where they can become employed and then thereby allow other individuals to then qualify for a voucher.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much.
If you have any questions, I believe what you're talking about is the SEBRA bill, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of changes, that have been proposed. The legislation right now is in the Senate. And, we still don't know if it's going to pass because there are a lot of things also that may prevent it from passing, but it has a lot of good things. And one of those, it would be, I mean, if Section 8 had, I mean, some form of, I mean, pushing more people to self-sufficiency. I mean, we have other programs that are doing that, but it's not mandatory. So, I mean, we can hope. Hopefully, I mean, we're going to get, I mean, a good change for this program. Any other questions?
Well, then we're going to have to cut it off because we're running a little over time. But thank you very, very much for all that information, Lorena. Thank you very much for coming. And the first general session of the California Council of the Blind is hereby adjourned, and we'll see you tonight at 7 p.m.